This is Radio Democracy, a series of 12 commentaries by the noted author and political analyst Michael Parenti. This segment is titled Welfare for the Wealthy, How Corporations in America Feed Out of the Public Trough While Preaching Virtues of Self-Reliance to the Rest of Us.
Big business is fond of preaching the virtues of self-reliance and individual initiative. Big businessmen are fond of denouncing those who run to the government for handouts. In fact, no interest feeds more lavishly out of the public trough than corporate America. Successive Democratic and Republican administrations have dedicated themselves to supporting the corporate system. They offer an array of subsidies and services to business. They impose a taxation system that shifts costs and diseconomies onto the general public. And they launch military spending programs that have transformed the United States into a permanent war economy. Rather than a laissez-faire government that does little, we have a corporate state that plays an increasingly active role in sustaining the process of capital accumulation. The pattern of using the public's money to bolster the profits of private enterprise is as old as the Republic, but over the decades it's gained a lot of momentum. The federal government leases or sells at a mere fraction of market value billions of dollars worth of oil, coal, and mineral reserves, and grazing and timber lands. In any given year, the government hands out billions to big business in tax exclusions, tax credits, price supports, loan guarantees, payments in kind, export subsidies, subsidized insurance rates, marketing services, irrigation and reclamation programs, and research and development grants. The government pays out billions of dollars in unnecessarily high interest rates. It permits public funds to remain on deposit in banks without collecting interest. It tolerates overcharging by firms with whom it does business. And it provides long-term credits, tariff protections, and reduced tax assessments to large companies. Over $26 billion a year in federal crop subsidies benefit mostly big agribusiness and affluent farmers, with relatively little going to small producers. As of 1993, the federal government was losing up to $52 million a year by charging ranchers below-cost grazing rates on public land. In other words, it cost the government more to maintain the lands than what they were charging the ranchers. At least $97 billion in public subsidies have gone to the nuclear industry, and another $76 billion worth of taxpayers' money has gone to federally funded research and development, and this has passed straight into corporate hands without the government collecting a cent in royalties on sales. Under the Mining Act of 1872, companies mine valuable minerals and metals from public lands without paying royalties. One company is today, in 1994, mining a gold deposit in Nevada with an estimated value of over $7 billion without paying a royalty fee, and with the right under the law to purchase the land for $5 an acre. The U.S. Forest Service continues to open national forests to timber companies at below the cost of running the program for an average yearly government loss of over $31 million. The government directly subsidizes the railroad, airline, and shipping industries. The government subsidizes exporters of iron, steel, textiles, tobacco, paper, and other products. Energy companies have received huge amounts in grants and tax incentives to encourage oil exploration. Billions of dollars go to bail out such giant companies as Chrysler and Lockheed, while small businesses are left to sink or swim on their own. When one of the nation's largest banks, Continental Illinois, was on the brink of failure, it received $7.5 billion in federal aid. Another $8 billion went to the International Monetary Fund to offset the losses incurred by U.S. banks in bad loans to third world nations. No mom-and-pop business is bailed out when they go bankrupt or make a bad investment. Probably the most outrageous case of compensation involved DuPont, Ford, General Motors, and ITT, and it occurred during World War II. These firms owned factories in Nazi Germany that produced tanks, bombers, and synthetic fuels for the Nazi war machine. After the war, rather than being prosecuted for aiding and abetting the enemy, rather than being jailed as traitors, ITT collected $27 million from the U.S. government for war damages inflicted on its German plants by Allied bombings. General Motors received over $33 million for damages to its enemy war plants. No individuals who served in the Army received damages for losing a leg, an arm, a son, or anything else, or a home or property. Under corporate state capitalism, the ordinary citizen pays twice for most things. First, as a taxpayer who provides the subsidies and supports, then as a consumer who pays the high-priced commodities and services. Whole new technologies are developed at public expense. Nuclear energy, electronics, aeronautics, space communications, mineral exploration, computer systems, biomedical genetics, and others, all of them developed almost completely at public expense, only then to be handed over to industry for private gain. Thus, AT&T managed to have the entire satellite communications system put under its control in 1962 after U.S. taxpayers had put up the initial $20 billion to develop it. So the big corporations rely on socialism. It's a socialism for the few. The U.S. taxpayers, the government develops the thing, and then it's handed over to big business to profit off. The U.S. government, through its Agency of International Development, or AID, spent $1 billion in taxpayer money over the last decade to help U.S. companies move U.S. jobs to cheaper labor markets abroad. AID provided low interest loans, tax exemptions, travel and training funds, and advertising funds. AID also provided blacklists to weed out union sympathizers and organizers in various countries. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, the government poured over $500 billion into bailing out the savings and loan associations. Under the deregulated thrift market adopted during the Reagan years, the SNLs could take any investment risk they wanted with depositors' money, often at great profit to themselves. After all, the higher the risk, the higher the return, usually. They do this with the understanding that failures and bad debts would be picked up by the U.S. government, better known as the U.S. taxpayer. In many instances, the heads of thrift industries funneled deposits directly into family accounts, into executive salaries, or into fraudulent deals, sometimes involving organized crime and the CIA. When hundreds of thrifts failed, the government had to compensate depositors. By the way, these depositors, 90% of them held accounts of over $100,000 or more. The Federal Savings and Loan Corporation issued promissory notes to new investors who took over the failed SNLs. Without Congress's approval, the Federal Savings and Loan guaranteed the principal and interest on all loans, including many that had been written off as worthless. And this amounted to the biggest bailout and financial scandal in human history. The people who have benefited the least from deregulation are the ones now most burdened by the SNL cleanup, the ones now held responsible for the costs, the ordinary taxpayers. We have Ronald Reagan and George Bush to thank for this, and Bill Clinton has done nothing different about it. The corporate state strives for optimal investment conditions at home and abroad. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, known as GATT, facilitates international investment mostly in ways desired by the multinational corporations, undermining environmental and public protections and labor standards, and undermining a host of human services. So with the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which gives a free hand to big corporations in Canada, Mexico, and the United States, in effect enabling multinational capital to invest where wages are at their lowest while paying little or no taxes and undermining labor gains and health, safety, consumer, and environmental protections. In sum, free market advocates who constantly admonish the poor to lift themselves up by their own bootstraps are the first to turn to the government for fat handouts, bailouts, special services, and privilege protections and supports. The free market state uses taxation as well as public spending to redistribute income in an upward direction from the mass of the people who live off wages and salaries to the select few who live off dividends and interest rates and land royalties and rents. Taking into account all taxes on sales, services, and private income at the federal, state, and local levels, as well as Social Security payments, we find that lower-income people pay a higher percentage of their earnings than do upper-income people, while generally getting much less in return. Over the last dozen years or so, the trend has worsened. The wealthiest 1% increased their income by over 85%, while paying 23% less in taxes. In 1992 alone, they raked in more than $71 billion from tax breaks. The rich have grown richer, but their tax rate has declined. The poor have grown poorer, but their taxes have increased. Income from property ownership, from dividends, interest, land royalties, and rents, has risen 3 times faster than income from work, that is, from wages and salaries. And the inequality is greater after taxes than before. The proportion of federal revenues coming from corporate taxes has dropped dramatically from 50% in 1945 to 8% today. In other words, big corporations used to pay half of all federal taxes, and now they pay only 8%. The result in revenue loss has to be made up somewhere, and it's made up by an increase in taxes on middle and working class earnings. And it's made up also by greater government borrowing. In 1983, a working mother with 3 children and a salary of $10,000 paid more federal taxes than Boeing, General Electric, DuPont, Texaco, and AT&T combined. These companies paid nothing, though they enjoyed combined profits of almost $14 billion. Profits, not income, profits. After the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which was supposed to abolish such corporate freeloading, 16 major firms, including General Motors, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and Greyhound, still paid no taxes, despite combined profits of almost $10 billion. Instead, they received tax rebates totaling $1.1 billion. Not without cause did the multimillionaire Leona Helmsley say, quote, "We don't pay taxes, only the little people pay taxes. The federal tax code is written to allow the wealthiest interests to enjoy lightly taxed or tax-free income, including tax-free bonds and tailor-made write-offs and exclusions. Companies can deduct for production costs, wages, marketing expenses, advertising, business meals, travel, entertainment, investment incentives, operational losses, bankruptcy, interest payments, and depreciation. American-owned shipping companies incorporated in foreign countries are exempted from U.S. income taxes. By manipulating the prices charged among their own subsidiaries, multinational companies can concentrate profits in countries with lower tax rates and pay almost nothing to the U.S. Treasury. Overseas earnings that are not repatriated are tax-exempted. And oil and mineral royalties that firms pay abroad can be treated as tax credits at home. Every year, over 100 of the largest private utilities collect taxes on their monthly bills to customers. But by taking advantage of write-offs, they are able to pocket most of what they collect. So in other words, that tax you're paying on your utility really ends up as a profit to the private utility owners. In addition, some 338,000 companies are illegally pocketing almost $4 billion a year in Social Security and withholding taxes from their employees' paychecks. They don't send it in. Relatively few of these delinquent firms have been prosecuted. Tax cuts are supposed to spur new investments, but studies show that firms enjoying reduced taxes actually have cut back on jobs. The rate of investment today, now that the rich pay less taxes, is no better, and if anything, more sluggish than in earlier years because of the decline in consumer buying. The additional billions in tax cuts that the rich won under the Reagan administration do not go into new investment, but into higher dividend payments to stockholders. It goes into bigger executive salaries and into luxury consumption and quick profit speculation. So this idea that if you give the rich a lot of breaks and taxes, they'll have more money, and with that more money, they'll invest, and with those investments, they'll create more jobs, and it'll all trickle down to us, is really not true. Those additional billions, they pocketed, or they used in speculation or in self-indulgence. Creating a super-rich class does not bring prosperity. Numerous third-world nations have extremely wealthy classes that live lavishly off the backs of the common people. In countries like El Salvador, in Haiti, in Mexico, in Argentina, in Zaire, there are ruling classes that are filthy rich, fabulously rich. And this does not bring a general trickle-down prosperity to other people. In contrast, social democracies like Sweden and Denmark tax their rich companies and wealthy individuals heavily, enabling their citizens to enjoy a higher and more equitable standard of living than do third world peoples, higher and more equitable than do Americans. It has been argued that taxing the wealthy more heavily would not make any appreciable difference in federal revenue, since they are relatively few in number. In fact, if rich individuals and top corporations paid a graduated progressive tax of 70% with no loopholes or major deductions, hundreds of billions of dollars would be collected yearly and there would be no federal deficit. Just the deductions that corporations claim for the interest on their business loans costs the government nearly $100 billion a year in lost revenue. In the early 1980s, a 39% reduction in the top tax rate, benefiting the richest 1%, caused an annual revenue loss of at least $70 billion. These are not trifling sums. There are several ways people can be taxed. First, there's the progressive income tax. This imposes a substantially higher effective tax rate on the rich than the poor. Thus, in 1980, the very richest paid 70% in income tax and the poorest only 18%. I mean, that's really an exaggeration, because the 70% tax rate was not quite as severe as it sounds. It did not apply to the entire income. The tax was graduated so that the very rich paid the highest rates only on those portions of their income that went far above middle brackets. The lower portions of their income, they paid the same tax rate as a poor person. The assumption made with a progressive income tax is that the burden should fall most heavily on those who live the most privileged lives, who have an abundance of surplus funds beyond what is needed for necessities. Next is what's called a proportionate income tax, or flat tax. This imposes the same rate on everyone, regardless of ability to pay. Thus, if both rich and poor pay, say, 20% of their income, then a person who earns $10,000 pays $2,000 in taxes and has only $8,000 to live on, while one who receives $1 million pays $200,000 but still has $800,000 to spend. Those who advocate a progressive tax consider the flat tax to be unfair, for while everyone is paying the same rate and the richer person is paying more dollars, the poorer person will have a harder time of it. It's cutting into the bone, not into his fat, because he has very little fat to go on. A dollar taken from someone of modest means has a greater deprivation impact than a dollar taken from the very affluent. Finally, there is what's called regressive tax. It's even more unfair than a flat tax, for it imposes a higher effective rate upon those who have the least. Instead of paying the same rate as in a flat tax, rich and poor pay the same actual amount in actual dollars as for instance, with a sales tax. When both a janitor and a top executive pay the exact same amount of sales tax on a gallon of gas, the janitor is sacrificing a far greater portion of income than the executive. Sales, excise, and Social Security taxes are regressive. Given the many tax loopholes that have been available to rich persons and corporations, the progressive income tax has proved to be not all that progressive. Under the Reagan administration, the progressive tax was practically abolished. It was reduced from 70% top bracket to 28%. Today, the federal income tax is close to a flat tax in its rates. And it's really a regressive tax, in effect, because it still allows many write-offs for business and big earners, taking proportionately less from the very rich than from the rest of us. And after all, John Q. Public, or the average blue-collar worker, has very few tax write-offs that he could claim. The unjustly regressive nature of our tax system is even more evident at the state and local levels. In 45 of 50 states, the poorest 20% of the population pay higher state and local taxes than the richest 1%. Taking all the above into consideration, it is no wonder a retired Internal Revenue Service employee wrote that he and his colleagues were convinced that the nation's tax laws are, quote, largely legalized deceptions that encourage wealthy individuals and corporations to escape with little or no tax payment, while the middle class and the poor pay punitive taxes to make up the deficiency. When government expends more than it collects in revenues, this is known as deficit spending. To meet its yearly deficits, the government borrows from wealthy individuals and financial institutions in the United States and abroad. In other words, they borrow on the future earnings of the U.S. people. The yearly accumulation of these budget deficits is what is known as the national debt. By 1940, given the deficit spending of the New Deal, the national debt had grown to $43 billion. The cost of World War II brought it to $259 billion. By 1980, it had climbed to $908 billion. After Reagan was in 8 years, the national debt tripled to $2.7 trillion. In 4 years under the Bush administration, the national debt almost doubled to $4.5 trillion. So the rate of accumulation is going greater and greater at a higher rate. And Republican administrations bring out budgets which have deficits that are every bit as big and often bigger than Democratic administrations. So the growth in deficit spending has several causes. First, there's the billions in lost revenue because of the tax cuts we were just talking about a minute ago. The government is now borrowing furiously from the same people it should be taxing, the rich moneyed interests. Second, in 8 years, Reagan spent almost $2.5 trillion on the military, and these allocations had a budget-busting impact. Third, the national debt itself contributes to debt accumulation. Growing at an increasing rate, it becomes so huge that the interest paid on the debt has been expanding than the economy and has been expanding twice as fast as the budget. Every year, a higher portion of debt payment is for interest alone, with less and less for retiring the principal. By 1990, over 80% of all government borrowing went to pay for interest on money previously borrowed. Thus, the debt becomes its own self-feeding force. The interest paid on the federal debt every year is the second largest item in the discretionary budget, after military spending. Who gets the hundreds of billions in yearly interest on the bonds that the government sells, the treasury bonds, to float their debt? The individual investment firms, banks, and foreign investors with money enough to buy them. Who pays for all this? Ordinary working people who contribute most of the taxes. Interest payments on the federal debt constitute an upward redistribution of wealth from those who work to those who live off personal wealth, which is why conservatives like Ronald Reagan were not too worried about a big debt. Moneyed creditors lend their surplus capital to the U.S. government and watch it grow risk-free at public expense, backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, just as the framers of the Constitution intended. We and our children will be paying increasingly larger sums to service this astronomical debt. As Karl Marx wrote 150 years ago, quote, "The only part of the so-called national wealth that actually enters into collective possessions of modern peoples is their national debt," unquote. They may take our land, our timber, and everything else. They may take our airwaves. They may take the treasures of mineral deposits in the ground, but they'll never take from us our national debt. That will always be ours.
You heard Welfare for the Wealthy, Part 3 in a 12-part series of commentaries by Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is the author of many books, among them Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths. Here is a brief preview of our next issue of Radio Democracy.
Why does the United States have such a huge military empire, the largest in the world? Why is it that almost half of all the arms and guns and shells and weapons are produced and owned by the United States? Well, one reason is that military spending is an important way to accumulate capital for the few while shifting most of the financial burden onto the many. In the 12 years of the Reagan and Bush administrations, the Department of Defense, also known as the Pentagon, spent an astronomical $3.7 trillion. Military production grew at three times the pace of U.S. industry as a whole, three times faster. During this period, the United States maintained upwards of 1 million military personnel and civilian employees and their dependents in over 350 major bases and hundreds of minor installations in 35 foreign countries. The military is the single biggest polluter of the environment, contaminating the air, soil, and groundwater with plutonium, lead, fuel, lubricants, solvents, and other toxic wastes, while creating over 90% of our radioactive waste and amassing a stockpile of tens of thousands of tons of lethal chemical and biological agents. There are some 21,000 contaminated sites on military bases and at nuclear weapons plants. In 1990, the military used 16 million tons of ozone-depleting materials and had almost 10,000 military specifications calling for ozone-destroying chemicals. In sum, one of the greatest dangers to the security and well-being of the U.S. public and to the planet itself is the U.S. military.
Michael Parenti coming up on the next segment of Radio Democracy. For a copy of this talk and one other by Michael Parenti, please send $4 for one cassette and ask for Part 3, Welfare for the Wealthy. For the entire 12-part series on six cassettes, send $24, that's six cassettes for $24, to People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington 98199, USA. That's People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington 98199, USA.